Will you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Our speaker is being recorded tonight with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren. I'd like to introduce this evening's speaker, Joe from Encinitas.
Good evening, I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Karen. Thank you for the introduction. I appreciate that. It's nice to be here. This is, of course, one of those meetings that have been around since, I think, 1939. Fred and I were chatting before the meeting, and I want to thank Fred also for the nice introduction when I came in. It was I was warmly greeted and shown the ropes a little bit, and that was very nice, and so I appreciate that. I want to thank Marcia for asking me to come down and come up here. I'm from San Diego, so I came up. Come up here and speak tonight. It's always a privilege to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to congratulate our birthday person, Darren. Congratulations. And I also want to welcome the newcomers. So if you're new, welcome. I hope that something that I share with you tonight may ring a chord, that you may find here what I found here, which is a way of living that is beyond comparison for me. And I can tell you that's not where it started. Before I get into my pitch, you know, I think I'll share with you a little bit of my background, maybe, just to give you a little bit of who I am and what I'm about. I come from a big family of five boys and two girls, and, you know, there was just a whole slew of us running around, and, you know, I was the oldest of those five boys and two girls. Grew up in a little bedroom community in Los Angeles, and, hey, you know, I don't know. You know, for me, I think I was born with the ism. You know, I can just remember as far back as when I was a young person going to school, I was self-obsessed, self-absorbed, all I thought about was me, 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 me. And I would sit there and I would think, what do you think about me? You know, I mean, it was like everything revolved around my own self-absorption, you know, and I thought I was painfully shy, which is really just a form of ego. But I didn't know that, you know, but that's the way I grew up. So I grew up with that kind of, you know, self-absorption that I didn't have a name for it. I just thought I was painfully shy, you know. And I tried to do my best as a kid, you know, to not bring attention to myself. Maybe do the schoolwork and kind of like just slip under the radar, you know. That's all I really ever wanted to do. And that's the way I went. That's the way I went through school. And as I got older and I got a little bit more into, you know, the middle school years and then into high school, and I still walked around with that same self-absorption. I used to stand in front of the mirror sometimes and I would look in that mirror, and this is what I said to myself. I don't know if other kids were saying this. This is what I said. You know, I would stare into the mirror and I would say, what's wrong with me? I'd look in that mirror and I'd say, what's wrong? Now, my family would see me staring into the mirror and they'd say, oh, God, he's so vain. You know, look at him. He can't take his eyes off himself. But that wasn't what was going on in my head. What was going on in my head is, you know, what's wrong with me? And so I carried that with me. You know, I walked around with that. And somewhere in high school, somehow I got a girlfriend. So that was a big step. You know, and so, and I, as I got in, you know, I was moving along, and I walked into a high school party, and I walked in with all of that ism, and my friend Rick was standing there. In those days, we had kegger parties, and Rick was standing there, and they had the keg going, and it was iced down, and he poured me a nice big glass of beer, and I took that beer, and I chugged that thing down. And he poured me another one. And before I even got the other one down, the miracle happened for me. I mean, what I know now, what I didn't know then and what I know now is that was the closest thing in my life up until that point of something similar to a spiritual experience. I mean, alcohol, the dramatic effect that it produced on me was that I went from that painfully shy, self-absorbed, you know, little nerd to Superman. I mean, it was like bottle rockets. It was like all of a sudden I was a part of. I was kissing the girls. I was fighting with the guys. My girlfriend got angry and left me, and it was wonderful. And I didn't know it. But if there was an invisible line that you cross and you become an alcoholic, I crossed it right then. Because I knew for me that that worked for me. That worked in a way that nothing else worked for me. I can remember I had brothers, and they went to church, and they were Christians, and somehow they talked me one time into going to one of these little youth groups, and I can't tell you if I'd had a drink or not had a drink, but so we went to the youth group, and they opened with their prayers, and they gathered around, and they had a wonderful little time. They were laughing at their jokes, and you know, and they all seemed to know the particular Bible phrases or whatever. And I know that my brothers, you know, they were trying to help me. So they thought that would help me. But I can tell you that in that particular group, I was crawling out of my skin. I mean, I knew it did something for them. But what it was doing for them wasn't working for me. And so when I found alcohol, and I found out that alcohol could make me feel like I thought they felt, I was doomed. Because I was going to chase that from then on. And that's what I lived for. I lived for the party. From that moment on, that's all I ever wanted. And so I used to go, I mean, I used to be on the hunt. Every weekend I'd go on the hunt. Got to find a party. Got to find the booze. Got to get loaded. Because I got to feel like that. And I went through my high school years then from being a good student, kind of a nerdy little shy kid, to being a partier. And that became my reputation. And as I went through, now I was still able to function then. I mean, alcohol was working for me. It had a powerful effect. And it was able to work for me, and I was able to have fun. And like we've, you know, you'll hear this in many meetings. First it was fun, then it was fun with problems, and then it was nothing but problems. And that is the story of my drinking career. So at first it was working for me and things were good and things were happening. And then there were problems that started to creep in. And instead of going 4 years through college, it took me six, you know, because there were other priorities in my life. But somehow I graduated from college, you know, and I'm not quite sure how I did that. And I got out and I got a career. And it started to do what's done to many of us. It started to have those effects. Like I started going out for happy hour. My friend Dave and I were talking about this one time. I went out for happy hour. And just to have a couple toddies. And came to, at, I think it was 5 in the morning. I was lying in a field. I still had on my business suit. I was lying in a field. I was sleeping on a dirt clod. So that was my pillow. And somehow there were like a bunch of weeds around, and the weeds were like sticking out of my suit, and anyway, and the sun was just coming up, you know, and I got down out there on Coast Highway, and I started looking, where's the car? Now, I don't know about you, but I was always losing things, you know. Where's the car? Where's my credit cards? Where's my wallet? Where are my pants? You know, I mean, it was always something, right? And so I'm looking around. And I start walking down Coast Highway trying to get back to the last bar that I remember that my car might have been at, you know. And so I was working my way back there, and just I knew I had a meeting at something like 8:30 that morning, you know. And so I was like, man, Dave said I probably looked like a scarecrow. So I probably did, you know, the hairs, you know, but that's the way it went for me. And then and then I discovered that, you know, the alcohol, if you mixed it with certain alcohol enhancers, white powdery enhancers, you know, you might, because what happened is I started to have blackouts, you know, and the blackouts became very frequent. I thought, okay, well, what I'll do is I'll start mixing it with this little formula over here that somebody had introduced me to. And if I can get the formula just right, I'll be able to continue on with this and I'll be okay. And so I started trying to go down that path. And then it became this whole balancing act of trying to keep all that together, trying to show up, you know, trying not to go into blackouts, trying to have the everything just sort of work out for me. And I started having lots of problems at work. And in fact, a boss of mine called me in one time, and I had just been to, I think it was a Super Bowl Sunday party, and I'd just been launched down the stairs at the Red Onion by someone, you know, and I was out in the parking lot, and I had to have emergency dental surgery the next morning, you know, and then go in for my business review, you know. So I walked into the business review, and my boss was, you know, we really need to talk about some things. And I go, okay, here we go. I know what's coming. And he said, you know, I really want to talk about your reputation because, you know, you have a reputation of being a good time Charlie. And I was like, oh, thank God. I thought he was going to talk about my drinking, you know, and I was like, a good time Charlie, man, I know what to do about that. I just got to suck it up. You know, I got to get serious at work. I got to show that I'm engaged. You know, I've got to get intense, and I've got to, you know, not party it up so much, and, like, you know, really show them I'm committed. And so I did that for a while. And then, you know, it's just funny when you're drunk like I am. Have you ever watched that Andy Griffith show and there's Otis the Town Drunk? I mean, I began to think of myself as Otis the Town Drunk, you know, because I'd go out and the next thing I'd know, I'd be getting peeled off the streets by Newport's Finest, you know, or Costa Mesa's Finest. I figured it out one time. I was in the Costa Mesa jail. I was in the Newport jail several times. I was in the Palm Springs jail. So I was only really going to some nice jails, you know what I mean? And then I ended up in the Escondido jails, and I ended up in the Vista jails, and I ended up in all kinds of jails. And, you know, not for a hard time. I mean, it was just the let's let the drunk sleep it off. You know, let's get him sober. And, of course, there were the times when I was, you know, I was like, okay, I got a DUI, which was, okay, that's a wake-up call. You know, I'm in my 20s now. I've got a DUI, and I've got all these other issues going on. And I'm like, man, I'm never going to do that again. I'm never going to drive drunk again without some cocaine to kind of keep me, you know, balanced out there. I got to have something in there, you know, to get it if I get back on the road again. A month later, of course, I did not have my cocaine, and I was arrested again for drunk driving. So within 30 days, you know, in those days, that was in the 80s. Man, I don't know what you do now. In the 80s, they reduced one of them to reckless driving or something, and the second one, they said, you know, they didn't cross, so they both went down as first time offenses. That's just dumb alcoholic luck, right? I mean, they no computers in those days, you know. The only place I got caught was in Sacramento. So anyway, and then they took my license away. So you know what you do then? Just drive carefully. Yes, you know. It's like, it's, you know, so. And that's the, I mean, that's the way I was living, you know. And so, you know, relationships. I was terrible. I was a terrible boyfriend. If you got into a relationship with me, I mean, I just made your life miserable. You know, I mean, I wasn't faithful. I was a cheat. I was a, you know, just a dog, you know. And so every part of my life was just a mess. And that was the alcoholic life I led. And so sometime one of my girlfriends finally, she got me a big book, and she underlined in the big book, "Here's the fellow who's puzzling you. You know, he's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde," you know, and she had that all highlighted and everything, and, you know, had me read that, you know, and the funny thing is, when I read that, I said, you know what, I know that actually is describing me. I don't want to do anything about it, but that, you know, that's describing me, and that's, you know, that looks, you put my picture there, you know, that's who I am. And, you know, has a promising career, wants to build up the career, then pulls it all down upon his head like a deck of cards or whatever, you know. So I knew that was, you know, I knew there was something wrong with me. I started seeing therapists, you know, psychiatrists. You want to kind of figure out, hey, what's wrong with me? You know, I'm still on that same, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? Don't want to give up the alcohol or the substances, but, you know, I'd like to figure it all out. That would be good. get all figured out, you know, and then I wouldn't have to have all these problems that keep happening, you know. I'd get all sort of managed out. That would be good. Very good. Couldn't do that, no. So, somewhere in there, so I'd had the second DUI. I was in my late 20s, and I was convinced by my therapist I should go to an AA meeting. So I went to an AA meeting. The AA meeting was in Laguna Beach, and there were a group of guys there. And Chuck C was one of the guys there. I mean, that was cool. I didn't know who Chuck C was, but everybody was Chuck C's there. You know, that was pretty cool. So I went there, and I saw these guys, and the only thing I remember from the meeting is that they were like sharing stuff, and then they stood up, and then they kind of said a prayer. They held hands, they said a prayer at the end, and then that was that, you know. And then they all broke out of there, and I was like, wow, that was interesting. Man, if I ever need them, I'll know at least where they are. You know, that's not for me, you know, because a couple guys got my number, and they were like, hey, we're going to be doing this thing or that thing, and I was like, sober? You know, yeah, sober. Yeah, we don't know. Oh, no, I can't make it. You know, sorry. You know, I can believe doing things, you know, without something in me. I had to have something in me at all times, especially if it was something social. You know, this is not my natural form to stand up here and speak. I mean, this is like out of my element. So, you know, for the guy that let's say for the guy that I was. Now I actually like to speak. So anyway. So for that the guy that I was before I got sober, you know, that was not natural to do things socially without something in me to pick it up, you know. So and then not long after that, I had another really bad incident, and I said, okay, I got arrested. Here's what happened. I don't like to share this, but I went to like an awards banquet. And I went to this awards banquet, and I thought, you know what, I got to have a little toddy here as I walk through looking at all the awards. In fact, I may even win one. You know, I mean, I was in the advertising world, and, you know, I was like, hey, I might even win an award. Drinking my little scotch, walking through, looking at all the exhibits. Didn't have any of that white powdery substance, and at some point in there, I don't know if it was after that first drink or whatever, I was in a blackout. So what I remember now is mostly told to me is on the big video screens that they were recording in the room. Apparently, I tried to accept every award that was being given out that night. And when asked to leave by the host of the awards banquet, asked to, you know, please, you know, as a typical drunk, right? You know, they just want to get you out of there. Come on, let's get this guy out of here, you know. I didn't think that was a good idea, and you know how it goes. I mean, I just made a complete ass out of myself. And in any event, to make things even worse, I'm in front of all my colleagues. They, because I won't leave, they end up calling the Newport Beach police. I'm unceremoniously handcuffed in front of the entire industry. Hauled out of there in handcuffs, put in the patrol car. When I come out of the blackout, I'm in the Newport Beach jail, and I'm like, well, you know, what am I doing here? And I could barely remember things from the night before, but the things I did remember, I was like, oh, my God. You know? Did that really happen? I think it did. Here I am. And, you know, so I was 28 years old, and I said, okay. You know, that was the bottom for me. I was 28 years old. It was 1985. It was February the 19th, 1985. And I said, I'm going back to where those guys were. You know, that group of guys that looked like they knew what to do and knew how to live life without drinking. And I'm going to go find out what they're doing, and I'm going to do that. Because I want to be like that. And so I went back there, and I found those guys, and I found recovery, and I jumped into recovery. I jumped in with both feet, and I said, I think there's an answer for me. And it was in 1985, and it was really active with Alcoholics Anonymous in 1985. There were lots of parties, and sober parties, and dances, and young people, and crazy, just fun things going on. And there were fewer meetings, so the meetings that you went to, like there was a meeting over in Hogue, and it was just full. I mean, there would be like, you know, 400 people, and it would be an awesome, just a party, you know. And it was just a great time, I think, to get sober. So I jumped in, you know, and I got a sponsor, and I got into the steps, and I and I worked it and I was honest maybe for the first time in a long time. And I started, it was interesting, I started to get it. I started to find a lifestyle in here that allowed me to be comfortable in my own skin without alcohol or without substances. And so I went along, you know, and I got a year, I got a couple of years. I met a gal in AA, you know, boy meets girl on the AA campus. And we got involved and we got married and then we had three little newcomers. You know, they just sort of went like bing, 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 you know, two boys and a little girl. And my sponsor moved north. My sponsor moved up to Davis and I moved south. I went to San Diego. And, you know, my wife and I decided, here's what we decided. We decided, hey, you know what? We're busy, man. We got all these kids and I got a career and all this stuff's going on. But we're going to be safe because, you know what? Our sobriety is bulletproof. And, you know, wherever two or more are gathered, that's a meeting. Yeah. And there's two of us and we're gathered. So we've got our own little, we've got our thing going here. This is a meeting, right? I mean, yeah. And so we didn't really get active in AA in San Diego, and you know my sponsor was an interesting guy. I mean he was never really that active in Alcoholics Anonymous either. It's just the way he was. He went through the Schick program where they caused him to projectile vomit for 8 days in a row or 10 days in a row or something, and then suggested he go to meetings afterward. And he did that, and he was a great guy. I really like him. In fact, I just spoke to him just not long ago. He's still sober. So, you know, and still participating in his program, which is, you know, occasional meetings, and that's wonderful for him. For me, I'm busy, man. I mean, I've got my career, I've got those kids, I've got that wife, and I'm on the road. And one day at a time, my sobriety began to slip away from me. I didn't know it. It was cunning, it was baffling, it was powerful. I didn't see it. I was angry sometimes and I didn't know why. The ism was telling me your life is a mess. This is terrible, this family, you know, your career, you're not happy. Nothing was making me happy. I wasn't sharing with anyone. I wasn't caring. One by one, I gave away my steps. So when I was almost 12 years sober, and I won't even say I was sober, I was 12 years dry as a bone. I rolled into a business meeting in Newport Beach, and I've been to a lot of business meetings sober. I've been to Mardi Gras, you know, sober. That's a scene. But so it wasn't like there was anything particularly, you know, different about that day. I went for a run on the beach. I went to that business meeting. And all I know now is that whatever it was that was the day. So sitting at that table with all those other business people, waiter comes over. I order my soda water. He starts to go away, and I'm like, wait. Make that a Cadillac margarita. And nobody else there was an alcoholic, that I'm aware of. They were all seemed to be drinking or whatever, and nobody else knew what was going on inside me. But as the waiter, of course, he's following orders. Hey, I got a drink order here, man. So he runs off to get the Cadillac margarita. Well, he's running off. What's going on in my mind is, I don't know if this is a good idea. I don't know if this is a good idea. You know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And the power. You know, it's like, I'm trying to say the serenity prayer. He comes back. He puts the margarita down here. It's now it's in front of me. God grant me the serenity. God grant me the serenity. God, thank you for curing me from alcoholism. I mean, it was like that. I thought I was cured from alcoholism. And I got a drunk going again for the first time in 12 years. And here's what I've often shared too. It wasn't even a good drunk. You know how that first drunk, it was so good for me. The effect was so dramatic. It wasn't even a good drunk. It was a bad drunk. I felt like a drowning man. And I knew it wasn't a good idea. And I call my wife and she's, what's wrong with you? It's, oh my God, are you drunk? Like it would never have occurred to her that I could get drunk. As an alcoholic, you know, that's my natural. That's what I go to. If left to my own devices, that's what I go to. And I went to it. And people said to me, you know what, Joe? When they found out, my sponsor said, he's got to get back in AA. He's got to go back. And like right now. And I thought, yeah, that's what I got to do. I got to get back into AA. And you know, I thought it'd be like riding a bike, but you know what? It wasn't like riding a bike. I had released the genie from the bottle. I had let go. I now was in battle again with a power that's greater than me that I lose out to. Excuse me, that I lose out to every time I go into battle. And it was swamping my boat. And people said to me, Joe, you know what? You've got a lot to lose, dude. You've got a career and a family and a home and stuff. And I said, you know what? I do. And I don't want to lose that. With all my heart, I don't want to lose that. I love those kids. I love my wife. I love my career. I love my life. Now, I was miserable up until, you know, I don't want to lose that. And I started losing it. And you know, so time went on, you know, and pretty soon the wife is saying, I can't live with you. If you're not going to get sober, I can't live with you. And the wife is gone, and that means the kids are gone. And so now I'm divorced, and I'm thinking, well, you know what? I got to get sober, man, because maybe she'll come back if I get sober. And I'm trying to get sober again, you know. Went on for 6 years. And for 6 years, I was trying to get sober again, because I knew what sobriety was. I knew what recovery was. And so for 6 years, I would come in and I would try and get some sobriety, and that feeling, that compulsion to drink would overwhelm me. And I would be out drinking again. And then I would come back again. Something terrible would happen. I'd come back in. I'd go down a little bit more down the ladder. And that compulsion to drink would overcome me, and I would drink again. At the end of those 6 years, I was homeless. I had literally lost everything that meant anything to me in my life. The things I cared about were gone. My self-respect was gone. And not only was I homeless, I wasn't quite homeless. I mean, I was living in a storage unit right here in San Clemente, you know? So I wasn't quite homeless. I mean, I had a roof over my head. I used to sneak into this. It wasn't my storage unit. You know, let me make that clear. My stuff was in there. I had stuff in there, but it wasn't my storage unit. It was somebody else was paying the rent. But I was like, I had the code and I had the key. So I'd sneak in there, go in the code. I'd sneak in there, you know, and I fixed up the door so that I could wire it closed. You see that program, Storage Wars? I was wondering, like, what would it, you know, if they popped open that storage unit, you know? There he is, sleeping in his little... I had the middle seat out of my van, my company van, which I failed to return when they fired me. I still had it, you know? I was like, they'll track me down, you know? Sooner or later, they'll find the van. I was running around with Indians out on the Indian reservation, and I was just... You know what? I was just living in craziness. I discovered other substances that keep you up for, like, 30 days at a time. You know, very, very busy. You know, don't need to eat, don't need anything, just need to gamble, you know. So I had no money left. I mean, the casinos wouldn't even let me in the casinos anymore. So I had no money left, no family left. No. But I'll tell you, the one thing that left me, the thing that hurt me the most, maybe besides losing those kids and my wife, my sobriety, I lost hope. You know, when you get down to the street level and you're on the streets and your best thinking's got you sneaking in and out of a storage unit. You know, and I thought, man, I'm 46 years old. I'm done. My life is over. I have lost everything in my life. I don't have a penny to my name. I don't have a cell phone. I don't have a credit card. I don't even know if I can find a pen to make a sign. You know? Won't work for money. or something like that. I don't know what I was going to put on the sign, but I was going to look for one. You know, so I'm sneaking in and I'm detoxing too. Because here's what happened. I was down in San Diego. That's where all the running people were, on the Indian reservations down there and all the little gangbangers and stuff down there. And that's what, those are the people I was running with. And I was sleeping on a welfare mom's couch down there and stealing her peanut butter, you know, to eat and stuff. And it was terrible. Just terrible. And I had only the clothes on my back. And somebody gave me a ride up here to San Clemente where the storage unit was. And they dropped me off there and I had nowhere else to go. And so I got stuck here in San Clemente. And that was a godsend for me, because without any resources, you know, it's hard for an alcoholic or an addict, whatever. It's hard to get going if you don't have. It's hard to keep going if you don't have the resources. I ran out of resources, man. So I'm living on the streets. I'm down to foot power. The old company minivan somewhere out there on the reservation. Somebody tried to hotwire it and shut down the computer, so it wouldn't start. You know, so I got nothing. I'm down to foot power. And I was like, you know what? I got to a place that it describes in the book as a jumping off place. And so the ism of my alcoholism was telling me at 46 years old, dude, even if you get sober, even if you're able to get sober, your life is, you know, your life is over, man. You're going to start over like you're going to be a hobo starting over at 46 years old. Your life is done. And I believe that to be true. I believe that if I were to start over, that even if I got sober, you know what? Even if I got sober, I got to sit in that. I got to take my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous and I got to live with the wreckage of my life. And I don't have a prayer, man. And so I didn't come in. But here's the deal. So I said the great alcoholic prayer. God, help me. And I started walking. And, you know, there's a story in the big book about the prodigal son who goes out and he parties it up and he destroys his life. And then he finally ends up, he's a Jewish guy and he ends up working in the pigsty, you know, and he's working in the pigsty. And then he's like, one day it occurs to him, hey, you know what? He says the great alcoholic prayer, God help me. And, you know, one day it occurs to him, well, you know what? My dad gave me all that money, but my dad's got a good place there, you know, and I can go back there and I could be like a slave to my dad. And that would be better than working in the pigsty here. And so he makes his way back. And that was a lot like me. I mean, I thought, you know what? I'm done. But you know what? If I can just make my way home, I'll be OK. Now, keep in mind, the last time I approached my family, they had called the Orange County Sheriff's and had me hauled off the property. So I wasn't too sure they'd be glad to see me coming back, you know. And at 46 years old, it's kind of tough. Hey, Mom, Dad, I'm home, you know. They were even coming by where I was homeless and handing me a banana and $5 every once in a while. You know, here you go. You know, just to kind of keep me going. I was going into fast. I was always looking clean shaven. I carried a shaving kit so I wouldn't look homeless. I'd go into like the Albertsons or whatever, push my cart through like I was going to buy something, graze on food in there so I could eat, you know, and then go out of there. Go to fast food places, just screwed up my order. I need a hamburger. You know, if you haven't been there, you know, take notes. These are good tips if you ever need them. But, you know, but so the thing is, at 46 years old, you know, I, and there was a little bar in that little storage unit. And I was thinking, man, you know what? If I had a coat hanger, I could wrap that around my neck and I could just kind of like, I could just end it here. I got that jumping off place. I couldn't imagine going on like that, you know. And then I couldn't imagine getting sober and having to live with that. And the ism in me kept saying, hey, man, your life is done. You are done, dude. What's the use? I think sometimes that's the worst expression in alcoholic can say. What's the use? What is the use? Even if you've been sober for a while, you know, you get to those places sometimes. What's the use? And so like that prodigal son in the big book who comes walking home, you know, and his father sees him from a way, way off there. And his brother's been staying home doing the right thing and everything. But the father, you know, runs out to see him and takes his best robe and he puts it on the son and he brings the son home. And he says, we're going to have a party. You know, my son has been returned to me. And my parents did the same thing. My parents saw me from a way off. And instead of like calling the Orange County Sheriff this time, they brought me in and they said, you know what? If you'll go to AA, we know that works. If you'll just go to AA, we'll give you a roof and we'll give you a place to sleep. And you can have a shower and you can have food. But you got to be willing to go to AA. And I was like, oh, man, those are hard terms. You know, because I don't want to go to AA. I've tried AA. I've tried it for 6 years and it's just not working for me anymore. It's just not going to work. And so they were a taxi for me for a couple of meetings. They took me to some meetings right here in San Clemente. I came to this meeting. Thank you for being here. One day at a time, I was in a little fog bank because I think I was detoxing for maybe the first year. And I was in a little fog bank and I just kind of sat there with my arms folded, angry, ticked off. You know, because I was like, I've run out of choices, man, and this is it. But here's what happened. I mean, day by day, when I was about 4 months sober, and I had so much wreckage. I had the IRS and the law was after me, and so much, there was just so much wreckage going on. When I was about 4 months sober, I was in a court-ordered program, because I had a lot of court-ordered things to do. And I was in a court-ordered program, and the gal that ran that program saved my life. The exercise that night was we had to write a resentment list. And so I wrote, you know, who were we most resentful was. And I was like, I'm kind of resentful at that guy that stole my stolen car. You know, that guy really ticked me off because I needed that car, you know, and that guy stole my stolen car. And then I was kind of mad at this other guy and this other, you know, in all these situations. And I finally realized when I was going through that exercise that the number one person I was ticked off at was myself. Just the mess I'd made of my life. And so we were sharing that as we went around the room. And so she said, you know, who are you ticked off? I said, I'm ticked off of myself. And she said, you know, Joe, maybe you want to take a look at the fact, first of all, you don't make good decisions when your brain is full of, you know, booze and drugs. That's A number one. But second of all, alcoholism is a disease. You're not here to get good, dude. You're here to get well. And what we want to help you do is get well. And I don't know why I'd heard that before. I mean, it wasn't the first time I'd heard that. But for whatever reason, it cracked the door open. And I said, you know what? That is it. I remember that. Alcoholism is a disease and I need to get better. I don't need to get good and I don't need to get moral and I don't need to get, you know, I just need to get well. And I don't know why the door cracked open, but when I was driving home from that session with the court-ordered alcohol program, the stars just seemed a little... I realize now that what I had is I had a little bit of hope again. A little bit of hope. So, from that moment where I got that little bit of hope until tonight where I stand before you, wholesale miracles have happened in my life. Absolute miracles. I'm one of those speakers, you know, sometimes, your life got so fantastic, you know, when you got sober, good for you, you know. Yeah, actually, I enjoy it. You're right. It's good for me. I mean, I've had wholesale miracles happen. I've got a beautiful career now. My family has been restored to me. I've got, you know, a good program working. I'm comfortable in my own skin. I'm a sober member and a good member in standing. I'm current with my sponsor. I've got a life that's beyond my wildest dream. I have hopes today. I have dreams today. For that guy on December 11, 2002 that thought his life was over, and that the ism said, don't even, you know, there's no sense in even getting sober. To the man I am today, I have had the best 9-plus-something years of my life, of my entire life, up till tonight. And with that, I'm going to close. So I want to thank you all for being here. I want to tell you that if you're new, you know, keep coming back. And I hope that you'll find here what I found here. Thank you for letting me share.